Sassy Jack Stitchery is happy to be a sponsor of Fiber Talk. We so appreciate all the heart that Gary and team put into their show, and we always look forward to each episode. Thank you, Fiber Talk, for all you do for our needlework world. Sassy Jack's is a vibrant needlework shop located in the mountains of western North Carolina, just north of Asheville. We're in the process of moving our shop to its forever home in a historic folk Victorian on the National Listing of Historic Places, just 3 miles down the road from our current location. While we're moving, you can find us in all our normal online haunts, our website at sassyjackstitchery.com, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. We can't wait to open our doors and welcome you into our new old home. It was always the plan to be in this beautiful old house, and we've invested a huge chunk of our hearts into its renovation. Every renovated board, every push-button light switch, every old porch swing has lovingly, mostly, been placed there with our own hands. It has a wonderful, warm, welcoming feel about the place already, and your stitchy joy and laughter with friends will really make it home for Sassy Jack's. So look for us online for the next few months, as we'll be filling online and phone orders as per usual, and we'll be looking forward to the spring at the Baird House in Asheville, North Carolina. When the time comes, we'll leave the light on for you, just like your mom did when you were a kid, so you'll know it's time to come home. Now on to the show.
Back. I'm Gary Parr, and you are listening to Fiber Talk, the twice-weekly podcast for needlework artists. Our artist this week, after a three-year hiatus, Terry Bay. Welcome, Terry.
Thanks, Gary. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you. I can't believe I looked that up. We were getting ready for this. 3 years since we last talked.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And so if you want to learn about Terry's background, how she got started, all that stuff, just go to wetalkfiber.com, look up Terry Bay, and you can listen to that one. And hear it all, because we're not covering it here. We already talked about it. So, yeah. So 3 years, and in there, this pandemic thing that we're still dealing with. Always curious, you guys who teach live and teach live a lot, what's that experience been for you in terms of learning technology and doing online courses?
It's been a steep learning curve. You'd have told me a year and a half ago that I would be all about Zoom and recording videos and knowing not only how to record them, but how to upload them and how to post them. And I would have laughed at you and said, no, I'm not a techie. I don't do those things. And now I'm doing all of them. The heartbreaking bit was last year I had several seminars planned. I know at one time, on my travel app, I had 6 trips that I had already bought plane tickets for and everything lined up, and just canceling them one by one by one by one.
Torture, just torture.
And I just kept thinking, maybe we can hang on to just one of them, and no.
I don't think people realize, for you guys as teachers, your prep work is so far in advance. And kits, and you have to purchase all the materials for the kits. And by the time you actually get to the class, the huge amount of work is way in the past. And to have those canceled is just painful. Yeah.
And I mean, usually starting prep work for a class, sending out the proposals and things is usually 2 years in advance. And if it's a class that has not been taught before, then you have to involve all of writing the charts, getting the charts proofread and proof stitched and back and forth. So yeah, by the time you get to a seminar, it's been a good 2 years in the planning.
And then there you are holding the bag. You can't do it. Yeah,
exactly.
So has all of this, obviously you're much more tech savvy than you ever wanted to be.
Amen.
I was going to say, than you were before, but no, I think it's than you ever wanted to be. But
true.
has it made you a better instructor? Have you seen that? Has it forced you to do things that have made you better at teaching, or is that yet to be seen?
I think so, and I think it will continue to develop. I've had to think of a lot more of what I can do relying on what I've written and what I've recorded, and not so much on immediate feedback by looking at people, by seeing their reactions. So you have to put more thought into how do I relay this technique so people who are visual learners can figure it out, people who read, who learn by reading, people who learn by doing, people who learn by watching. I've learned to factor in all of those, or I'm trying to factor in all of those ahead of time instead of depending on my visual cues to see if I need to back up and do something again.
Yeah, because that has entered my mind more than once, because we live 3 doors from a school, and I have all the sympathy in the world for school teachers. I can't even imagine what that's like. And because, yeah, you do. I mean, I'm a former teacher long ago now, but it's that the vibe in the room that guides you through the entire session, and hard to pick that up when it's just faces on a screen. No, no, that's got to be a big adjustment. The and then of course you've got the technology part involved in that. I mean, you're geared up to just simply teach how to do needlework. And there's this big technology part that you also are responsible for, which is, yeah.
Fortunately, I have family members here who are very tech savvy. I have become the cliche of the parent that looks at their child and says, "How do I do this?" Because I have two of my three children have ended up living with us basically because of the pandemic. They were both in transitions as the pandemic hit, and neither one could then rent apartments while everything was shut down. So we've all been a big happy family here for the last year. And but it's been beneficial because I had them around while I was off my feet. And also, it's like, "Heather, I need to post this video to YouTube. How do I do this?" And she just talks me right through it. So that part's been really great.
Well, there you go. Timing is everything. Everything.
Yes.
Yeah, that's right. You had the foot surgery too, and so that timing
Yes.
was perfect in terms of downtime.
Right.
What has this done to your designing? Have you become a better designer? Has it given you a pause to kind of re-rack? What's happened in your head?
The first, I would say, 6 months of it, oh man, I churned out so many designs because so many of the external distractions were gone. I wasn't packing to leave to teach every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks, and we weren't going out to see the Broadway shows like we would do once a month, and we weren't traveling to see family. So I was here and sitting here with all of my lovely toys and, all of your lovely threads and materials, and I could play with things. And I'm still trying to get models stitched up of some of the things I got designed a year ago.
Oh, so you really unloaded
Oh yeah, I did so much.
then.
My poor family didn't see me, even though we were all locked in the house here together. They'd be like, "Mom, you want to come have supper?" "Oh yeah, wait a minute, wait a minute. One more line."
But that's interesting, because I know you artists have, you just have stuff stored in your heads. And it's just really a matter of time for them to come out. So you were able to
Absolutely.
just unload and get all that down on paper. That's terrific.
And I had the reassurance of my husband has a fabulous job and was able to work from home. So we didn't have a lot of the financial stressors a lot of people have had through this. So I was very, very blessed in that. So I could just hole up and create for what, 4 or 6 months it was really.
Now, of those ideas, what percent really hit the mark? How does that break down? Do you have a lot of ideas that go, once you start them, it's like, nah.
Yeah, it's like, yeah, you look at it and say, "Oh, nope, that didn't work how I thought it would." Really, of that big COVID spurt I had, if you want to call it that, I'd say about 75% have come to fruition.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's
I mean,
excellent.
a portion of those are still on paper. I haven't, because I stitch all my own designs before I do anything else with them. So I'm still there. I've got a couple, three left here that I haven't had time to stitch up yet. But yeah, a lot of it came together really well. I did have some that no matter what I did, I just couldn't make what was in my brain work with what was in my hands. But for the most part, it all came together.
That, I mean, that's impressive to me because I expect you to say half, and just because you have ideas and once you start to work on them, it's not so exciting. But wow, 75% or so. That's
Yeah.
yeah, you really did have a good run then.
I
That's
sure did.
great. Now, does this when you're going through that? And doing a mind dump, if you will, of these
Yep.
ideas, are more forming? How, is it the stream? Does the stream keep going in your head of design ideas, or were you so wrapped up in those that part stopped?
It hasn't stopped, but I'd say it's slowed down.
Okay.
Yeah, I got a lot of what had been brewing in my brain for the last couple of years down because, like I say, I had time to just totally immerse myself in it. And they've been trickling since then. It hasn't stopped, but I don't have quite so much stored up in my head as I did before.
Yeah, okay. All right. That's just it just yeah, it interests me how that works because I know you pick up an inspiration here and there and it just chews around in your head for a while and becomes something and how does that play out? Have you also felt your design work evolve and advance, or what happens to you there?
Well, it's got to evolve to an extent because if you keep putting down variations on the same theme, then people quit being interested in you because it all looks the same. So you've got to keep trying to find that new shape, new design, new pattern, new combination. So that's constantly playing with things that come to head, things I see, things I steal from my daughters. Well, literally, my middle one does origami.
Oh.
And there have been times where she's folded up something, and I've just looked at her and said, "Give me that." And then I start to work with what the shape she's done. She's also drawn several mandalas for me
Oh.
that I have. One, I can't say where or how, but one has been booked for next year that is based on one of her designs. So. Yeah, it has to evolve. You have to keep evolving. Has the pandemic itself changed that? I don't think so. I think it's just a continual process.
That's always in the deal. Because I wonder. Well, I think you can say that for just about any technique, but with hardanger, how do you keep finding fresh things? Because they can easily all start to look like variations on the theme.
Exactly, yeah. And that's especially with the Hardanger, the Ukrainian, a lot of these techniques that are more geometric. It is harder because you can only put squares together in so many ways to make them look new and fabulous. And part of that for me is playing with 3D shapes instead of just everything being flat. Or, okay, it's normally in a square. How about if I make it into a diamond? Or figure out how I can make it as circular as possible. You can't go totally circular, but you can fidget with it. Yeah.
Well, and I suppose, I think that the limiting factor for that is if it's always white work, then you really are locked into your shapes and your arrangements, where other people
Right.
can change colors
Uh-huh.
and do things and get away with not a lot of variation in design, but do it with color. But you don't have that option.
No, we can't depend on color for our picture. It's all positive space, negative space, the play of light on your thread, which is why we use shinier threads. Yeah, so you're not depending on color.
No. Do you now? And I've noticed that some black work going into some of these designs, and you
Yeah.
even have some with color in them. I don't know. You're gonna get in
A
trouble
little
there.
bit. Well, as I say, if I put color in it, then I just don't call it traditional white work.
Yeah.
Because it's not traditional, then you call it modern or you call it a variation. You know, things have always been, like you say, evolving. So what was traditionally Hardanger was white on white or ecru on ecru, and it was linen threads and linen material. And now it's evolved into a whole bunch of materials, a whole bunch of threads. It needs to evolve. It needs to evolve to keep people interested, to keep the art form moving forward.
Yeah, that is Hardanger and Ukrainian and all those are so steeped in tradition,
Yes.
and of course the expectation is that you'll stick to that tradition. So if you very
Sometimes yes, sometimes no.
do people get their feathers ruffled a little bit if you go off the reservation?
Oh
Yeah, okay, all right. Yeah.
yeah, I do my eyelets differently from a lot of Hardanger teachers. And I have learned when I start a class and I get to the eyelet section, I just flat up look at my class and say, okay, here we go. This is Hardanger heresy. We're gonna do it different. And I call it Hardanger heresy, and then people usually seem to be much more accepting of it when I flat out say that, yeah, no, this is not the way it's always been done. But hey, I like this way better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you gotta try things. I mean, you gotta
Yeah.
be honest and true to the tradition, but at some point you gotta go a little off in left field there. Yeah.
Well, and I've always said too to my classes, how did this become the traditional way to do it? There's one of two ways. Either it's something that's very structurally specific and you need to do it that way, or it's going to cause you problems down the road. Or it's however the woman, the person with the strongest personality decided this was the way it was done and this was the way she was going to make sure everyone else did it.
Now there's a perspective right there.
So if it's a solid structural thing, I stick with it because, yeah, I'm not going to reinvent the wheel. But if it was, you really could do this another way and you're not going to be able to tell when it's finished, then I'll experiment.
Right. Yeah, and people should feel free to do that. Yeah, if you
Absolutely.
get the same look another way and it works for you, do it. Yeah. There's nobody going to write you up.
Well, and then there's people like me that are left-handed.
Ah, yes.
So the way a right-hander does it is not necessarily going to work for me. So I get used to adapting already.
Yes. Yeah, I relate to that left-handed thing. Yes. Yeah. Is that have you had to become ambidextrous in your teaching? Or
Yes,
okay.
absolutely.
Yeah.
A lot of stitches I can do with either hand now. Especially I've discovered with doing demonstrations on a camera, I've got my fabric on a fixed stand and the camera is only 3 inches above the fabric to get the best picture. So I can't rotate the fabric and I can't always use my left hand, so I end up using both hands.
Adapt to survive.
Oh yeah. Absolutely.
So where is your design work going these days? Is it the color and incorporating black work? What are you working toward next?
I'm not sure if I say I'm working towards something. I'm
Okay.
trying not to be a hyperactive squirrel jumping from one thing to the next, but my brain goes there sometimes. I'm actually, one of the things I'm doing right now is a very traditional white work band sampler. But then I'm also doing a lot of the black and white because that's really popular because it's just such a striking combination.
Yeah.
And the colors have come about because when my husband and I were in Australia, I discovered cottage garden threads and I've just fallen in love with them. And I love using their variegations in my pieces. So more and more of those have been sneaking in. I'm never going to be a crazy color person. Usually when I do color, it's I choose one variegated to go with my solids, and I base the solids off the one variegated. So it's not as, I mean, some people can do amazing color theory and throw together combinations that you would think would be horrid, but turn out beautiful. With me, I pick a variegated and stick with its tones because if somebody's already done something that looks beautiful, I'm not going to mess with
There we go.
it.
Now I have a small set of those cottage garden threads, and yeah,
Oh,
they're
aren't
very
they
nice.
fabulous? Yeah.
Just right. There's too many threads in this world these days. I don't
Oh, I
know.
know, I know. And every time we travel, I find some new one, and I want them all. That's the problem.
Now, does that pull at you to do more color just because of what's available? Or,
Oh, yeah.
yeah, okay.
I mean, you see all the pretties hanging on the wall, and you start to think, "Ooh, I could do these things with them." But and then I always end up gravitating back to the white work because it's just what, you find that technique, that genre that just kind of fills your soul. And for me, it's the white work. It's very contemplative and very soothing.
Yeah, that's I've always been attracted to the white on white. There is something about that. The texture, it always it just impresses me when it's done well, what you can get out of something that has no color to it, and the visual impact it can have if it's done well. And if not done well, it just sits there. But done well, it really to me is almost more impressive. It's kind of like to me with photography. When I first started, I was told learn to shoot black and white because you can cheat with color, and you can't with black and white. And for me, white work is the same kind of thing. You can't cheat with it. It won't. You can't put in a blue here and have that work. It doesn't
And make
fly.
that pop. Yeah, yeah.
So is that where do you still find room to grow in hardanger and white work in general, room to grow in terms of designs and finding new levels and new areas, or are you feeling like now it's a matter of finding the variations that work?
I am still finding new things because I've been doing a smattering of other white work techniques that I'm starting to pull into a little bit. I've looked at a little of like the Richelieu and the Ponto Antico that have some different and a little more free form weaving patterns. And I'm starting to pull in a few things. So when you find something like that you can maybe like spice up the hardanger with just a little bit. It's still needle weaving, but yet instead of anchoring it at certain corners, you're kind of letting it curve a little bit and doing things like that. And then, too, I have found another thing I found that's been really interesting is to dig through secondhand book sales, a lot of seminars because the Ruth Kern bookstores quit going, have had members donate books and do sales like that at their seminars. I've been able to pick up some very old books, and I'm finding stitches in those that I am not finding in the newer books. Sometimes I have to, a lot of your old patterns, you pretty much got a picture. If you're lucky, a black and white chart and an order of stitching. Do your stitches in this order. And that was it for instructions. So some of these I'm having to experiment to try and figure out how in the world do you exactly do this stitch, but it's been fun. It's been a challenge.
In history you find new things. That's fun. That's fun. And that's interesting now, combining other techniques together to get a look that you're after. And I can see where that would put a real challenge in your head in terms of how do I make these cooperate with each other.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's got to look cohesive. It can't obviously be two different things put together. You want it to be one whole picture.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and I think that is where a lot of people miss out, is they don't realize, if you look, how much white work, how many white work techniques and variations there are. There's just a tremendous amount.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, hardanger is just one of them. I mean, just there's so many, and yeah, I can imagine when you start combining them, you can really start to see some options. Talk about your basics. What's your go-to ground cloth and your go-to thread? What should people look at if they're wanting to do some white work?
My personal go-to ground cloth is indeed linen. I like linen because it's a natural fiber. Natural fibers are woven and spun from threads that are a finite length. When you think of a piece of flax or a sheep's wool or a cotton ball, everything's a finite length. And when that gets spun, it leaves little Barbie ends that stick out here and there. So when you cut and when you pull, it's going to want to try and stick together and to stay together. Your synthetic fibers, your synthetic threads are extruded from a machine, so they're all perfectly round and smooth. So when you try and do pulled work, they want to slide back to where they were before.
Mm.
So they're not as forgiving. Your synthetics, the fabric's going to want to buckle more, whereas your linens and your cottons are more forgiving and will move more the way you want them to.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I love linen. You got to play with it. If you get a big slub in it, which linen has slubs because it's a natural fiber, you can try and pick it out. You can work around it. You can just leave it there and say, this is linen, and that's the beauty of it. My favorite threads have to be the pearl cottons. Linen thread was more of a traditional, but I personally don't like the way linen feels in the hand.
Oh, okay.
Other people love it. It's a personal thing with me.
Mm-hmm.
I also like the pearl cottons because, especially when I'm doing classes, I try and stick with materials that are readily available. So my student doesn't have to search 5 different stores, 10 different online shops to find. Everybody can find a ball of DMC pearl cotton in white.
Yep.
You know, yeah. So I strive for things that are easily available for classes.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I'm going to do something for myself for fun, then I will go into like a 40 count linen and I'll start searching through silk fibers and things like that. But then I'm not making students find those things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's that has come up more than once in conversation. Is as a designer that you always have to look at that in terms of, can your students and the shops that they go to readily get the materials that are needed for the class or the project. But then as a designer, just doing something for yourself where you don't have that limitation, you know, what happens? What can you do and how do you do it? And to me, it's all right, I want to see what you do for yourself. I want to, you know, even if it's hard material to get, I want to see what it is, just to see what happens when you work with a different, you know, when you don't have to use DMC pearl.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. That's, I mean, because to me, that's, it cuts you loose. It cuts your, you know, and you can just, so you're like your maximum, your ultimate design skills can really show through.
Right.
Yeah, because it just always makes me wonder when I see a design, how much of this design, and compromised isn't the word, but did any of this design get altered just so people could actually get the materials and do it?
Yeah, it's about being practical.
Right.
And what you do when you don't have to be practical. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just completed a Hardinger series. In fact, one level of it I'm teaching right now for an EGA online course. And another level's been picked up for next year. But again, I can't say what yet because, you know, each seminar has to make their own announcement first.
Right.
But the basic and the intermediate and all those levels were pretty, you know, pretty practical. And then I went absolutely nuts with level six. They're all, I call it my snow series because they've all got snow forecast names. Mm-hmm. Like the one I'm doing for EGA right now is some accumulation.
Uh-huh.
So the ultimate one is called Blizzard Warning. And I did go completely nuts on that one. I don't know if it'll ever be taught as a class because I'm not sure even 4 days would do it on that one.
Uh-huh.
I will definitely put it out retail. It's going to take a while to write that chart, though.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, because that's the other part, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
The more complex, the harder it is to write up the instructions. Yeah.
Yeah, my EGA online course right now has 40 pages of instructions. And that's the basic intermediate level. So, no, I don't just give you a picture and stitch order. I give a lot of instructions.
Yeah. Well, you have to. You want everybody, as many people as possible, to have success. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember I went into a shop. It was a project I wanted to do, and there was some specialty thread. And the shop owner just goes, "Oh, these designers and these threads." And she was, her complaint was that she couldn't just order a couple of skeins, that she had to order, you know, X amount of it. And she was afraid that she was going to get caught holding the rest of the inventory.
Yeah. The minimum order problem.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it really is a factor. And I felt for her for a bit, but I really wanted to do the project, so it's kind of like not my problem.
Yes. Oh, I've had discussions with some of the Canvas teachers and their frustrations where they get, and some of their projects will use 20, 30 or more skeins of thread.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get one skein from one manufacturer that gets discontinued.
Oh, yeah.
And you can't just swap out that one because all of the colors are interdependent on each other.
Right.
And for them, it's a real problem. And that's when I kind of sit back and don't say anything because when I admit that, for me, it's white, and I'm done.
Yep.
They kind of want to lynch me at that point.
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's always going to be a problem, and especially if you use a lot of colors or different threads. And, these days with online, 5 years after you introduce it, somebody picks it up and everybody gets excited about the design. And now they all want the thread and it doesn't exist anymore. And,
oh, I know.
Yeah.
I know.
Hard to win.
But yet, we love those specialty threads so much. They're so beautiful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Are. Yep. Fun to collect, fun to use, all those things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I've got a room full. I think we all do.
Yeah, I'm sitting right here, and we're getting ready to move, and most of mine is packed away, and there's still, yeah, that was a shocker when I started packing things away, because I had two big tubs. All right, everything's going in here, I'll be good to go.
Oh, no.
And, about four more tubs later.
No. Yeah, we moved here 6 years ago, and that was... Yeah, it was a room's worth, and the moving people just kept getting more boxes and more boxes.
Yeah, when it's a few skeins at a time, you don't appreciate how it accumulates. Yeah.
Oh, I know.
Right. When you're working on your designs, skill levels, do you make a conscious effort to design for different skill levels, or do you do a design and then figure it is really an entry level or intermediate? How is there intent there, or do you just let the design do its thing?
There's intent.
Okay.
Especially, like I say, when I did this Hardinger series, I just kind of decided I was going to do 1 through 6 and graduate the levels. Most of the time there's intent. Occasionally I get a design that just doesn't cooperate and ends up being something totally different than what I thought it would be. But for the most part, like I will go out and I will ask on my Facebook page, hey, what do you need right now? What do you need? And funny, because I've got some of the people in EGA and ANG that are on their national boards. And when the national education director says, we need beginner designs in this, you listen. So there have been times where I have definitely said, okay, I need to develop a beginner Ukrainian white work course. And I go from there. And honestly, the beginners are the hardest for me because I want to embellish. And I personally like the crazy, difficult, intricate things. So for me to pull it back to make it a beginner level, to make it a practical, realistic beginner level, can be hard for me.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that. Because, yeah. No, it can't do that. That's going to be one step too far. Yeah.
They will end up curled up under the table crying if I try to make them do this. I can't do that.
Is there demand, particularly now that people have had more time to stitch, is there a growing demand for white work designs at the entry level?
I think so. I think across the board, entry level has had more of a demand because, we've all had a lot more time on our hands this last year. And hopefully we can keep it going from there. Keep getting people involved and, keep building the levels. We always want to have entry level on hand because, there's always being new people born and growing up. So there's always going to be somebody's going to need that beginner level.
Yeah, I hope too that, I mean, there's just been such a surge of needlework with the pandemic, but really it was really growing and surging before then. It just did kind of a next level overnight thing, but yeah, I hope that this can keep going and maintain when people are back to work. People talk about I had all kinds of time to stitch. I never had that. Of course, like you, I've been fortunate, been able to keep working from home, and so I've not been laid off or anything, and have not had the time. And I feel for the people who say I've got all this time to stitch, and that there's maybe a downside to that too, and that's unfortunate. But yeah, I just hope that as the pandemic subsides, eventually goes away, that we do see the interest and the enthusiasm continue and even keep growing. I hope we can do that.
Yeah, me too. Me
Yeah.
too.
Yeah, there's just, I mean, there's just so much it has to offer.
Yes. I know there's a huge demand for classes in 22.
Is there?
Oh, yeah, my year's booked full already.
Oh, great.
I cannot squeeze another thing in 22.
Good.
It was amazing how fast it filled up.
Well, that's good. So that's a sign right there that
Yeah,
it's
everybody wants to get out and do classes again.
Now, when you look at classes for next year, are you looking at strictly live, or are you feeling like you're going to continue to incorporate online component?
The classes will be either live or online. I don't want to get into doing hybrid classes because that's just one step too many for me. When I'm teaching in person, I am all there and all in. So to try and remember to do things for online people at the same time, it would not work.
I see.
A couple of people have asked me to do hybrid, and I'm just, I know my limits, and I would lose one or the other groups. I don't think I could keep both groups going at the same time. Now, I will keep doing online classes because they fill a big niche, because we have members that either can't get out and travel for health or monetary reasons, or they live somewhere where the nearest airport's a 2-hour drive away. Whatever it is, a lot of these people are online now And having online courses is a fabulous thing for them, and certainly fills a gap that we had before the pandemic. We were starting to address, and then we pretty much had to address it.
So,
I hope to continue to do both.
Okay, well, that's good. And I've talked about this before. One of the pluses of the pandemic, if there can be pluses, is just that it's opened up needlework to a lot of people who just simply couldn't get to it before.
Right.
Yeah. So that's I hope that I assume that will continue, and I think that's where a lot of the growth will come from, is that group of people. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think we all will continue that. I mean, as teachers, we've seen how valuable it is. And honestly, since we were forced into it, it's not as difficult or intimidating as we thought to get courses out online. I mean, it was always, you know, the unknown, how am I going to make the technology work?
Yeah.
And I have to say, my first real time I dove into that was last year with the ANG seminar, when they decided to go online. And they did a fabulous job of supplying all the tech support, which kind of eased me into it, because they took out that whole technological factor for me at first, and I can concentrate on figuring out how do I make this two-day in-person class work as a four lesson online class. And I got that figured out in my mind on how to break it down. And that's not a problem anymore. I can look at my charts now and figure out how to break them down for online.
Mm-hmm.
But since they did the technology part, I didn't have to figure out both of those at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So now with EGA coming up and asking me to do an online course, I was like, yeah, sure.
Okay.
This is easy. I can do it. And I've done a couple others. I'm doing another one this fall for a chapter on how to finish the Lotus boxes. And yeah.
Yeah. Well, and there's another thing that is a real benefit, is these small chapters that can't afford to have somebody travel to do a class.
Right.
Becomes approachable for them now.
Yeah.
Yep. And you can just sit at home.
Well, more or less. I have to make sure the room's clean behind me, at least.
Yeah, there's a factor. Yeah, what's showing behind the camera? Let's be careful here.
And one of the daughters living with me right now has two cats, so I have to make sure they're corralled before classes. Oh,
okay.
Or they will photobomb. Oh, yes.
Yeah, they have cats. Former cat owner.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, they have a way. They want to be in the middle of it. Yeah.
They sure do.
Yeah. But there's a lot of those small chapters that I think it's been a shot in the arm for them to be able to have instruction that before all they could ever really do is just get together. And
right.
Because, you know, just don't have the resources. So, yeah.
Small chapters, remote chapters, because we've got some chapters that are pretty isolated from any other chapters, so it's not often they get a teacher even in their area.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, can't piggyback off of somebody else, yeah.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
Stuck. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah. No, and that's great. I mean, I feel, and I talk to people, and, well, we're a chapter of 12 people, and we just can't
afford it.
Yeah.
Basically, because when you think about paying for travel and then the teaching fee and buying your kits, and it can add up real quick.
Yeah, it sure can, in a big hurry. Yeah, just the travel costs. I mean, for my for my paying job, one of the standard things, if people want us to come to conferences or seminars, standard thing is you get here and we'll cover your hotel. And it's so huge, you know, 3 or 4 nights in a hotel is a huge chunk of money. And so then it makes it approachable. And, as a small chapter, all those $150 a night hotel rooms and meals and pretty soon you're in pretty deep. So, So what are you doing? Oh, I have to ask about, the last time we talked, we learned about the Lotus boxes.
Yes.
And now you have these spiral designs.
Yeah. That was, I was looking at an old Ukrainian white workbook, again, another old book, And they have a lot of what they call insertion stitches or joining stitches, which for their work, it was a lot of times it was making blouses, dresses, aprons. And these stitches were used to attach cuffs and collars and things to the body of the shirt or the dress. So basically, they're stitches used to join two pieces of fabric. And I thought these would be fun to teach. How do I teach them practically in a classroom setting? And so it's like I have one strip and I was trying to join two strips and all that. And then I just kind of wrapped it up one time and went, oh, I could just use the joining stitch to make this into a spiral.
Yeah. Okay. So that's where that came
and,
from.
And yeah. So it was basically looking for a way, a vehicle for the insertion stitches. And it was how, you know, watching my one daughter do origami has helped me because now I start playing with, and I do, I start wrapping things around and twisting them. And yeah.
Okay. That's interesting because there, it's a great design. My first impression was it's like kind of like icicles because I could see a whole bunch of those at Christmas.
Yeah.
Hanging on a tree or something. Yeah.
That would be neat. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, so I need to make some more sparkly ones.
Right. Yes.
There we go. See, you ask where inspiration comes from. There we go.
Yep. Get on it, Terry. Let's go. Let's go.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
But no, but those the design, because immediately I started seeing on a tree or hanging on a stair rail over a fireplace, whatever. But yeah, they really are a unique shape. And but that's what's fun about, because the last time we learned about the lotus boxes, I'd never seen anything like that. It's such a unique thing, and it's that doing something other than putting it in a frame and hanging it on a wall.
Right, yeah. Right. And you see that a lot. You'll get a call for proposals from a seminar, and it's like, and we are looking for things other than framed pictures.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Because, yeah, we only have so much wall space.
Right.
And then you start switching things out or doing seasonal. And even then you have to have storage space for the ones you're switching out. And
yep.
Yeah.
And round we go. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So do you try to have non-framed pieces as part of your mix all the time, or do they just come to you?
I work for them. I try to find them because, as I said, we all only have so much walls, so that it's always something in the back of my mind when a design comes out, how can I do this as something that won't need to be framed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you're successful at it, so.
Thank you.
Some good ideas, yeah. So let's give some people some tips.
Okay.
If I want to start, let's just use Hardanger just because
sure.
It's there. What what are some of the things that people that make people fear it or are hesitant to do it that they need to overcome? What where do you see the hesitation come from?
Number one across the board is cutting the fabric threads.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I hear a lot of times I put all this work into it, I get all this stitching done. What happens if I cut the wrong thread? You fix it. What happens if you make a mistake in some other technique? You take it out, you fix it. Now, with a thread, that means you have to reweave a new thread in place of the one you cut accidentally, but it's not that hard.
Mm-hmm.
So it's fixing it. And the best thing to do, there's two things you got to remember to make sure or to at least cut less threads wrong. Number one is to have good daylight and the right attitude, which means you're not tired, you're not grumpy, you're not mad at your spouse, significant other, cat, what you've read online, whatever it is. You definitely can't do this in a mood. You need to have good light. And the other thing is good scissors.
Mm-hmm.
If you use clunky, wide-bladed scissors, you're going to have so much trouble, you're going to get so frustrated, it's just not going to work. The good scissors are a must. They don't have to be expensive scissors. those little bitty $8 candy cane scissors or cotton candy scissors are really good for cutting fabric threads. And they're what I carry with me when I fly, because I figure if TSA decides to take those, they're not that expensive and it's not like my $70, $80 Dovos.
Right. Yeah, that's my flying scissor too. Yep. I'm sorry, we'll have to take that. Okay, fine. Whatever.
But give it to someone and let them enjoy it. Please just don't throw it away.
So, okay, so that's a good tip there because, that I know that you would immediately think, oh, I've got to spend a fortune on special hard-iron or scissors. And nope,
No, not
$7.
necessarily.
Yep, they're in a box right by the cash register. Just grab a couple.
And you make a mistake, but it can be fixed. Even doing this last Hardinger series I did. For one of the levels, I cut two or three threads wrong and had to stop and reweave new ones in. You don't, it's not like some magic thing that you become experienced and you never make mistakes.
Even the veterans do it.
Yeah, we do. You're going to make mistakes. They're going to happen. Just fix them. Don't let the mistake get the better of you. So that is, cutting fabric threads seems to be the biggest fear. I hear a lot on that. And my other big tip for replacing a fabric thread is make sure you use the same direction of thread you've cut. Like if you need to replace a thread going horizontally, make sure the thread you take off your fabric is another horizontal thread. Or if it's a vertical, take a vertical because the warp and weft of your fabric are stretched at different tensions. So they're going to look slightly different. So you want to replace horizontal with horizontal and vertical with vertical. And that'll help give you a more invisible repair.
Now, I would have never thought of that. I'd have just grabbed a thread. That's interesting.
Ah,
Okay.
yeah, keep it going the same direction as the one you need to replace.
Okay. All
It'll
right.
help.
And if I'm going to start out, what count of ground cloth do I use?
Oh, I would go starting out a 22 to a 25 count,
Okay.
somewhere in there, because you want it big enough to be able to see the holes, but not so big that it looks clunky.
And a straight linen, just a regular linen.
I would, yeah.
And then DMC, and you, yeah, I mean, usually the DMC thickness is determined by what you're stitching, and that's usually called out in the instructions. So,
Usually, yes.
You use a hoop, or what do you use to hold your?
Personally, I use Q snaps. The main criticism that people have, which is true, is they're kind of wide and hard to hold in the hand. And usually I either have mine propped on a massive couch pillow or in a lap stand. I usually don't try to hold them. I like the Q snaps because I can vary my tension. I can have it really tight for the stitches, for the needle weaving and things where I don't want to shift. But if I'm cutting fabric threads or doing something that I need a little more give, I can loosen. I can just rotate the snaps on the sides and get it looser. Now, Hardinger is often done in hand, and if you're used to stitching in hand and it works for you, then stitch it in hand. It's really a personal preference thing.
Well, that's not something I'd considered about Q snaps because I like the fact that you can get them tight all the way around, but I'd never considered that while stitching. Just rotate them in and loosen up the tension. There's a good
Because I like to
flexibility.
do my blanket stitches along the edges in a sewing motion. And that's much easier if you loosen the tension a bit.
That's all right. So, see, I've learned three things from you now. Like those,
Well,
yeah.
good.
All right, now help me with this one. Now, when you're wrapping bars, to me, just absolute tedium.
Yeah, a good TV show helps.
Okay, so it, yeah, all right, so it's not just me then.
No, wrapping and weaving bars. Especially if you've got a huge area to do it. I will music podcasts. FiberTalk's great to listen to while you're doing that.
All right, good suggestion.
TV show, because I don't need to be looking at it constantly either to help keep the wraps and weaves even. I usually keep a finger underneath to help guide that thread. Because if you're wrapping, sometimes those wraps want to go up over each other. So if I keep my finger underneath, it kind of blocks them from going backwards over the wrap you've done before.
Oh, okay. I can see that. Yeah.
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 No, there are some stitches that you've got a large ground and they don't take a whole lot of thought. So yeah, that's when I find something else to occupy my brain while my fingers go.
Okay. 'Cause yeah, to me it's like it's akin to back stitching and cross stitching. It's just like, shoot me. Now, all right, now this may seem silly, but do you just take the needle off the thread when you're wrapping bars? I mean, do you keep a needle on, or does you don't even think about that?
I'm not sure I'm understanding your question on that one.
All right, you have a length of thread, and normally you'd have a needle
Yes.
on one end. Do you just pull it off the thread and just start wrapping?
No, I always keep the needle on.
Okay.
Yeah, okay, there we go.
Oh, all right. Just curious. Yeah. Finger underneath. Okay. So, see, I learned something. 'Cause yeah, that part just bores me to tears. Like, shoot me. Just.
Yeah, it can't, especially if it's a huge area that you're
Yeah.
doing. Yeah.
And you have to do it right. You have to be careful because
Oh, absolutely.
it'll show up. If you get sloppy, it'll show up in a minute. Yeah.
It will. Uniformity is the key. Consistency is the key in Hardanger.
Yep. Yeah, 'cause you get those grids of open holes there, and if one's not right, oh man, it's the only one you see. Yeah.
Yeah.
Every time.
Oh yeah.
Yep.
It's like, yep, I looped that one stitch right there.
Yep.
I can see that.
From 100 miles away. Yep. Yep. All right, Terry. Fun as always. Let's not do
Thank
it.
you.
Let's not wait 3 years next time.
Sounds good.
Yeah. So check out Terry's designs. The Harlequin. Oh, the Harlequin one is, I think, my new favorite.
Yes.
Oh
Yep.
my. Where'd that come from?
Actually reading a historical novel.
Really?
Yeah, because they kept talking about this one minstrel that was wearing Harlequin tights. And I started thinking, Harlequin, okay, yeah, that can be multicolored or it can be like black and white diamonds, black and white diamonds, black. I can do black and white diamonds.
Yep.
So, yeah, that's where that came from.
Yeah, I think that's my new favorite right there.
That's, yeah, I'm doing that one for the EGA National Seminar this year. Yeah, that
Yep.
class is almost full, by the way.
Okay, let's go, folks. Fill it up. No, but what I like about that is the different treatments in the diamonds, but then just enough black work. You found just enough without overwhelming, and it really works. It's a beautiful piece. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. I like that one. So, okay, so that's it. Fill up that class, folks. Let's go. Yep. All right, Terry, thanks so much. Really enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Thank you, Gary.
Thanks to everyone for listening.